listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The news out of Ferguson, well, it's complex, and it's not good, it seems. Reverend he just vanished off my screen. Okay, Osagyefu Seku is on the line with us, Freeman Fellow with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is the oldest, largest interfaith peace organization in the United States. He's also the pastor for Formation and Justice at the First Baptist Church of Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, and has been in and is in Ferguson, was there last night, is there now. FergusonAction.com, by the way, the website. Reverend Seku, welcome to the program. Welcome back.
Oh, it's a blessing to be back, dear brother. I appreciate you keeping track of the best of the Fourth Estate.
Thank you very much. I'm curious your take on everything that's happened in the last 20 hours or so.
I mean, well, let us begin with the fundamental truth that on August 9th, our son laid in the street for 4.5 hours. His body was not met with the dignity of a funeral rite, a coroner, or an EMT, but police dogs, backup of police in riot gear. And then as his community took to the streets to bear witness to the essential violation of his humanity, they were met with tear gas, tanks, rubber bullets, and media and character assassination. And so, after a long, a torturous 100-some-odd days that they have not found any justice. At every level of government, these young people and this community has been betrayed. And so they found themselves going to the street and being angry and expressing a righteous indignation that included property destruction. But we must be clear. We must never value property over people. We must never lose track of the blood in the street and the blood-stained makeshift memorials that mark the American landscape all over this country. Every other day, a black mother or a brown mother is writing a funeral program that will perhaps be the elegy of democracy. And so as West Florissant burned last night, it meant that democracy is on fire.
Yeah, very well said. People talk of this as some pieces of this anyway, as a legal issue. It seems to me that it's a cultural issue. We have this is embedded in the American culture. There are issues of race and culture that are just not being addressed, it seems. And even this, you know, holding this press conference at 9 o'clock at night or eight o'clock, I guess, local time, it's like, oh, hey, let's light up the night. You know, why not do it the next morning? And if you wanted time to prepare or, I mean, I'm astonished.
It seems the case that is not simply a cultural issue. I believe it is a spiritual issue, and I don't mean spirituality necessarily connected to a holy other. I'm talking about the soul of the nation, which is democracy, is at stake. When young people cannot find any recourse in the justice system, and when elders and politicians and presidents are constantly telling them, trust the system, let the system play itself out, and then when that system betrays them, our call is for calm. Those who want peace without protest are like Christians who want the resurrection without the crucifixion. What we have seen last night, we saw Leslie McSpadden, the dignity of mothers who have suffered police brutality on the bodies of their children, literally collapse before 1,000 spectators. Because she could not get any justice. She was hoping, given all the information that she had, she still held out faith in this system, and the system betrayed her. And so tear gas and rubber bullets and militarized vehicles. And it's to my understanding, we got reports that even dogs were brought out last night. Yes, young people were upset. Yes, they destroyed property. Yes, they set fires. But the reality is that their life is always under destruction. Their reality is that they can be burned by poverty every day. Every time they walk into a school, they're burned by poverty. Every time they walk down the street, they're burned by police brutality. And so this has really presented a question before the nation. What kind of country are you going to be?
Yeah.
Are you going to be the kind of country that runs around the world exporting democracy and telling people how to engage as citizens while making it abundantly clear to black youth that their lives do not matter?
You mentioned Leslie McSpadden, the mother of Michael Brown. She and his father, Michael Brown Sr., issued a joint statement and, saying that they were profoundly disappointed that the killer of their child will not face the consequences of his actions, and, asking for a peaceful, peaceful reaction and positive change. One sentence really struck me. They say, "Join with us in our campaign to ensure that every police officer working the streets in this country wears a body camera." This is the most clear and specific call for action that I've heard from the family. Do you see that? I mean, it seems like a very, very reasonable and appropriate call for action and organizing principle. Is there anything happening around that?
I mean, well, you know, in Canfield, that emerges out of the struggle in Canfield. There are a group, Cop Watch, Canfield, Cop Watch Ferguson, started by David Witt, that provides cameras to civilians to police the police. And then there's been a number of calls from the Don't Shoot Coalition and others for these various forms of legal redress and policy redress around police behavior, police technology that will ensure the safety of the citizens and hold citizens accountable. And so, I mean, just imagine as a parent that you could not grieve your child alone, but you had to grieve your baby with the rest of the world and watch your child be persecuted, watch your child be mocked, watch your child be taken advantage of by the justice system while being betrayed by every level of government and the vast majority of civic institutions in the country. And so there should be a law, I think, that every time you say Leslie McSpadden's name, you have to stand up because of the dignity that she's displayed in the face of indignity.
I very, very well said. Where is the Fellowship of Reconciliation going with this?
Well, we've been on the ground for close to 100 days. We have staff in from around the countries and partners like Intelligent Mischief, as well as folks from the Baptist Peace Fellowship and Border Links and Stony Point and a variety of organizations who are working with us to try to keep track of these questions. We've done a number of trainings in nonviolent civil disobedience and tactics. We'll continue that work, and we'll do all we can to stand with and stand behind these young people who have kept the flickering light of democracy alive in these dark days.
Yeah. Reverend Sekou, you're doing extraordinary work, and we just have a few seconds left. Any sense of what might happen this afternoon or tonight?
Well, there'll be an action today. Folks are meeting at 12 noon Central Time in Keener Plaza, and there's an action that will come for that. And I'll say, as I always say, we have already won.
We have already? I'm sorry?
We have already won.
Oh, we have already? Oh, okay. Indeed. Reverend Sekou, thank you so much for being with us today.
All righty. Bless you, dear brother.
Thank you. Thank you. And you too. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be, Rashad Robinson is going to drop by in a few minutes, Executive Director of Color of Change, and I'll be taking your calls. I think we all need to kind of process this thing. And welcome back. Kenyatta in Redlands, California, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hey, Kenyatta, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to make three really quick points, if I could. you know, the whole, this whole thing is so specious. Every instance this happens, Trayvon Martin, Jordan Davis, there's always a national discussion on race. Few people remember that Barack Obama started his presidency out 6 years ago with a national discussion on race involving a beer summit because some professor was harassed by a white police officer.
Right.
And you know, the ensuing argument is always that there's anger and there's rioting in the streets. You know, I'm actually surprised that black people in America are as mollified as they are. What I mean by that is that in the history of this country, the only time there's been civil insurrection or disobedience by black people has been as a result almost exclusively of police brutality. They haven't rioted for better schools, which they probably should. We haven't rioted for better living conditions, which we probably should, but always this issue. And I think those scars, when you see those scars on those buildings in Ferguson in 1990, in the early 90s here in Los Angeles, those scars are the scars that represent the scar on the American soul.
Yeah.
Because this issue is not being dealt with. I just want to say one more thing, if I could, Tom.
Please.
The state of emergency that was declared a week or so ago, the mobilization of the National Guard, you know, these folks knew what was coming down. I think they specifically did it during a time where the weather was going to be cold, hoping that that would quell or at least suppress demonstration. I think they did it during the holiday week for that same reason. They knew this was coming down. They certainly did not do those things, the governor specifically, because he thought that this officer was going to be indicted. So the whole thing is just very suspicious, and I think the young people, young black people in this country, really aren't buying the let your voice be heard, we shall overcome thing. We've been singing that song literally for 50 years, and the same damn thing keeps happening.
Yeah, yeah. Good point. And I, you know, I remember back in the 70s, the riots in the 70s were provoked by police violence as well. It's just the other... I'm sorry. Oh
no, I didn't say anything.
Oh, okay, yeah, it was Shane. Shane gave me a 1 minute cue. I'm not often speechless, but I just,
I'm honored, Bob.
No, I mean, what you said was absolutely brilliant, and I see all these different pieces of this that I want to comment on, from the timing, from the way the prosecutor acted as a defense counsel in, you know, the what little we've seen and read, and Shane has been reading the transcripts of the grand jury testimony, you know, leading witnesses in ways that a defense attorney would do, not that a prosecutor would do, but ultimately. The larger issue here, which I think you just addressed very, very eloquently, is one of that scar of that goes back to the founding of this, in fact, long before the founding of this republic, of not just racism, but the history of slavery that, in some ways, even today, I mean, we call it wage slavery, but oppression is still here and still real, and now I'm ranting. Kenyatta, thank you for the call. Thank you very much. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Rashad Robinson is on the line with us, the executive director of Color of Change, colorofchange.org. Rashad, welcome back to the program. Hello? I can't hear you. I don't have a telephone backup for him. We are not hearing any audio. Yeah. Try the other Skype line. It just, yeah. So for some reason, Rashad, I'm very sorry, we can't hear you. So while Shane and Danielle try to work that out, I'm going to pick up some callers here. And oh, he's on the telephone now. Oh, great. Okay. Let me put him on the air. Rashad Robinson.
Hello.
Hey. Thank you very much for picking up the phone. Your thoughts and Color of Change's position on the events of the last 24 hours.
You know, Color of Change, we've been engaged in the issues around Ferguson, the issues around police police misconduct and criminal justice, you know, for years. And in particular, you know, we were on the ground in Ferguson in the days after, you know, Michael Brown was killed. We've worked with the community, and we've been working to bring a set of national demands around police accountability to the federal government. You know, we are unfortunately not surprised. You know, time and time again, when black folks and brown folks are hurt or harmed by police, we don't see justice served. And what Bob McCulley did, and even worse, to a worse extent, what Jay Nixon did in sort of stepping away from his responsibilities, the governor, you know, is what we continue to see all around the country, a justice system that simply does not deliver justice when black people are put in harm's way. And for us at Color of Change, we're hoping that this is one of those moments that triggers the type of energy and national response that can help us push for a national set of change. There are things that we can do at the federal government to incentivize good policing. There are things that we can do to hold our media accountable around the bias that gets put out. And right now, there are things we can do to sort of continue to push the Justice Department around their investigation to see if federal charges can be brought. And people can go to colorofchange.org to get involved. But you asked me what my position is, and my position right now is one of action, one of trying to take this moment and do all that we can to push for some real systemic change. So when we look back at this moment 5 or 10 years from now, we will remember the tragedy, but hopefully we'll remember this time of organizing and building.
There is a bias built into the system. Even setting aside the issue of race, there's a bias built into the system to not prosecute police for police misconduct. And this has been around for a long, long time. New York State tried to take this on by having, instead of having prosecutors prosecute police, having a separate agency do that. That was defunded, I think, in 1990. It only lasted a decade or so, and it didn't really work. Is there, in your mind, or you know, Color of Change, institutionally, do you have any specific suggestions about how we can change the institutions of governance or the institutions of the, you know, this problem, this built-in bias? Prosecutors work side by side, shoulder to shoulder with police officers day in, day out. They can't do their job without police officers. They need the cops to be giving the testimony if they're going to prosecute anybody ever. And then there's the very human element of the people that you hang out with and the people you work with are the people that you want to, you know, just instinctively defend. How do we break that link?
Well, you know, I think that you bring up so many of the points that continue to, you know, create this challenge where there's no incentive, political or otherwise, for prosecutors to you know, hold police accountable.
Well, if anything, it's the opposite is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
I mean, they,
exactly.
You know.
Yeah, that's the real incentive, not so. You're absolutely right. We need real community review boards that have teeth, that are monitoring and creating real oversight. We need, I do think that we need alternative institutions that are going to hold police accountable and cannot rely on sort of the prosecutors or state's attorneys and whatever sort of the body is in different states that are sort of responsible for this, that continue to not move forward. And there will be a number of state attorneys and district attorneys up for re-election in 2015. And at Color of Change, we're looking very strategically about the places that we can also, you know, move some of our energy. You know, there's Angela Corey down in Florida, who was made very famous during the Trayvon Martin trial. There's a number of these folks that are up for election, and we have to start putting this issue of prosecutors on the election map, especially as demographics in this country changes. So there is a systemic thing of that. We actually need structural reform, but we also need to pull the political levers as well in the meantime to start leveraging the energy of our folks in this moment to start going after some of these folks in election season and holding them accountable, putting them on the line, making them recognize and understand that, yes, they may hang out with the cops after work, but if they want a paycheck, they're also going to have to serve the people.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know of any communities or countries that have developed systems or are using systems to hold police accountable that get around to this, you know, systemic bias in favor of the police?
I mean, you know, there are there's definitely, there's some pilot stuff being tried in different parts of this country. It's also small, and we don't necessarily have any, and, you know, we don't have anything beyond anecdotal sort of information to go on. I do think, though, that what we do recognize is the problem is now simply too big to ignore.
Yep.
We've really entered, you know, Tom, we've entered this age of participation. You know, 23 years ago, when that Rodney King video surfaced, someone had to tape it. They had to decide whether or not they were going to send it to the studio. The studio had to, you know, at CNN had to decide whether or not they were going to show it. People went back and forth. They had discussions. Then they finally often, you know, decided that it was, you know, authentic, and they put it on the air. We are in this age of participation where we are going to have more and more of these moments because people are armed with cell phones and social media, and we don't have to wait on traditional corporate media to sort of validate stories and validate these moments.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, and it's a good thing. It's a good thing. Rashad Robinson, Executive Director of Color of Change, colorofchange.org. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Bradley.
Great talking to you. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And we'll be picking up your calls after the break. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's a sober day, you know. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. It's one of those days where you look out at the world and go, wow, you know, we are confronting serious. I mean, we've all known all along we're confronting serious issues, serious problems in this country. We have throughout the history of this country. On the other hand, it's also an extraordinary moment, the Michael Brown decision or non-decision. And, of course, there's still more to come. This is still playing out. But it provides us with an opportunity to, for example, talk about should every police officer in this country have a body camera? Or is that just, hey, let's throw some technology at this and that'll solve it, but it doesn't. You know, and the cops will just turn the cameras off when they're doing stuff they don't want recorded. And they'll, you know, it'll just become... Or not, you know, there's so many pieces to this, you know, changing the system so that the people who are depending on police officers to do their job, the prosecuting attorneys, are not the ones who are responsible for prosecuting police officers when police officers may have engaged in behavior that's illegal. I mean, this is just kind of fundamental stuff. And I realize that the media's principal fascination is going to be the kind of burn baby burn thing, but there are these issues that we need to be as a society grappling with, and I think we are. This is not a hopeless rant. It's a hopeful rant. But enough of my rant. Carl in Nashville. Hey, Carl, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I wasn't surprised by the non-indictment because, you know, let's face it, let's be honest with ourselves. A lot of people may not want to hear this, but there are two sets of laws in this country, one for white people and one for others. Black, Hispanics, whatever.
And then overlaid on top of that, there's two sets of laws, one for rich people, one for poor people. And then overlaid on top of that, there's two sets of laws, one for cops and one for everybody else.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, black people fall into the other more often than they, you know, fall into the obviously the white or the rich or officer.
Right.
So that being said, I'm not surprised. What I was surprised by was the district attorney and his the way he pretty much act like a defense attorney during the whole process.
Yeah,
that was shocking because people must realize that just because you're indicted, that don't mean you're going to get taken to trial. Just because you're taken to trial doesn't mean you're going to get convicted. And with an indictment, you know, we've always heard, you know, you heard the old line, a ham sandwich could be indicted. Well, obviously that's not the case anymore. I've never seen prosecution work so closely with the defense and so far away from the family of the victim.
Well, there actually is. Here's some statistics. And it, by the way, it was Chief Judge Sol Wachler of New York State who famously said that a prosecutor could persuade a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. According, this is from 538.com, a piece by Ben Castleman. And he notes that according to the Bureau of Justice statistics, U.S. attorneys have prosecuted 162,000 federal cases in 2010, the last year for which we have data. And he said grand juries declined to return an indictment out of 162,000 cases, declined to return an indictment in 11 of those cases, 11 out of 162,000. But then the numbers flip completely upside down when you look at police shootings. When you're talking about police shootings and this, you know, independent of race, although that's another variable, as you point out, that makes it even worse. But basically, police are immune from criminal charges and shootings. This is that's a verbatim quote from the Houston Chronicle investigation into what's going on with the Houston Police Department. In Harris County, Texas, he writes, for example, grand juries haven't indicted a Houston police officer since 2004. In Dallas, grand juries reviewed 81 shootings between 2008 and 2012 and returned only one indictment. And then, you know, he says there's three reasons for this. Number one is juror bias. These grand juries, these people actually sit on these grand juries for long periods of time, and they're interacting with the police constantly in a very friendly fashion, the number one. And then you got prosecutor bias. The prosecutor, of course, depends on the police to do his job or her job. And then third possible explanation is public pressure with the police shootings to take it to a grand jury, even if they think that there's a weak case. And he says these explanations aren't mutually exclusive. All of these things toss in there.
Absolutely. And you know, that what you just said just confirmed my theory of math being my favorite class in school. Numbers don't die. I mean, don't lie.
Right.
Women lie, men lie, children lie, but numbers never lie. They just don't lie. They're always right there. One and one is two, no matter how many times you try and put it together. And I'm going to end it with this time. We are at a crossroads here. Have you ever saw the picture of Emmett Till that his mother allowed to be put out?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that horrific. Sparked a civil rights movement. I mean, that it changed America, that picture being publicized.
That picture, and I would tell anyone, go look at that picture, and that's how you change a nation.
Yeah.
Now we're at phase two. Unfortunately, and maybe fortunately, there's no Martin Luther King come walking over the horizon right now in America. And if some mother decides to show a picture like that and they go viral in America, we're going to go one of two ways. There is no more kumbaya we can all overcome anymore. People are sick and tired of hearing that, and you can in fact have an American, hate to say it, Al Qaeda spring up, and it could get horrible in this country, or we can have a lot of young people that see the injustice that happened in Missouri, and they can say, you know what, I'm going to go into politics, I'm going to do things better, I'm going to pay attention to my local government, I'm going to get involved. One of those two ways, and the sad part about it, it just depends on which way the wind blow.
Well, I don't think so, Carl. I think all the evidence indicates that it's going in the second direction, that people are becoming activists, that the you know, the groups like Color of Change, the activist groups are growing.
Yeah.
The people are pitching in, they're helping out. The fact of the matter is there were demonstrations all across the nation last night, and I'm old enough to remember the riots in the 70s. And, you know, when I was 2 years old, I lived in a building in Detroit that burned down in 1972, I think it was. And mm-hmm. It must have been whatever year it was in any case. But my point is that, you know, that that spread all across the country in as violence. As far as I know, the only place that burned last night was Ferguson, even though there were protests all across the country. That's another piece of evidence, I think, that this is moving in the second direction you talked about, that rather than people getting
when you have hopelessness, and you look and say, you know what, Trayvon Martin, Mike Brown, I give up.
Yeah.
When you have that, I mean, you know,
but people aren't giving up.
And it comes to the point where people will say, you know what, I give up, or you can keep fighting on. And how much fight Black America have in them in this country, I don't know that. I don't have a crystal ball. I know that I'm willing, you know, it eats at me day in and day out to see these injustices keep happening. I mean, it's day in, day out, decade in, decade out, century in, century out of injustice against a group of people in this country. And one of these days, they're going to be like, you know what? Enough is enough.
Yeah. Yeah. We shall see. And let's not also, you know, forget the Native Americans who suffered a genocide and a Holocaust, and although that's a completely different topic, I suppose. But I don't think so. I think that the history of this country, you know, is just steeped in blood, and the blood of genocide, the blood of slavery, which and the genocide associated with that. This country is steeped in blood, but I am encouraged that there's activism happening around the country, and that it looks like peaceful activism. And Carl, your comments about people just, you know, having despair and giving up, I also we're seeing this, like, you know, with an economy that for 30 years has just ripped apart the middle class in America, and people are starting. Chuck Schumer this morning gave a speech here in D.C. about how Democrats have to start behaving like Democrats again and start talking about, you know, a positive and active role of government, how the country turned in 1980. And so, at a whole bunch of different levels, I think that people are waking up and things are moving in a positive direction. And I just, you know, hope and pray that we continue going that way, and that you and I, Carl, and all the rest of us can be agents of positive change. Carl, thank you so much for the call. And for listening to the program. We'll be back. It's quarter to 40, 15 minutes before you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your call. And, you know, your thoughts, my thoughts, we're going to process this thing. We'll be back. And welcome back. George in Chicago, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
I wanted to talk about the timeline for the witnesses on the day of the murder.
Right.
The young man who was with Michael gave a description of how Michael was struggling with the policeman at the car, with his hand trying to get away from the policeman, and the policeman was trying to pull him into the car, and then the policeman pulled his gun and shot Mike, and the boy was saying, "Mike." That's when Michael was able to get away from him.
Right.
So when he got away from him, he was running, and the boy ran before, because Michael told him, "You better run, man." And so the boy ran and got behind the car and watched Michael run past him. And as Michael ran past him, he was hollering at him, "Man, run, run." And he ran further, and he saw the policeman got out the car and started shooting at him. And when he hit him, he said he heard Michael grunt, like, "Oh," but he... That could have been in his arm, as they were saying, as he was running, or anywhere on that right side. And when Michael got hit, he turned and raised his hand and said, "Oh, you got me." And the guy started shooting again. And that's when Michael fell to the ground and hit the ground. a lady who was driving behind the police. She had to pull her car to the side because the police car had, when he had backed up to go to stop Mike, this lady pulled over into this driveway and got out of her car because the shooting had started. No, the shooting hadn't started, but they were arguing. She got out the car and seen them arguing, and Michael was struggling, trying, and she said the same thing. And this was the same day. It was possibly a couple of hours because they was just interviewing the people who were calling in and people who were credible. They were putting them on TV. Yeah. This lady came a couple of hours or so after the gentleman who was with Michael gave his description of what happened and gave the same identical description. And she was saying how he was trying to get away from the policeman. His hand was at the front of the car, and the policeman, she heard the gunshots.
Right.
And Michael jerked away from him and started running. She gave the same thing. And maybe I think that evening another man was in his apartment and looked out and seen Michael with his hands up. And the police.
Yeah, there were several witnesses who said that, and then there were witnesses who contradicted that, and the grand jury and the prosecutor decided to go with the witnesses who contradicted that rather than who said what you just described. And I don't think that is my personal opinion here. I'm not an attorney, but I don't think that's the job of a grand jury. I think that's the job of a jury in a trial when you present evidence and you somebody gives testimony and if it conflicts with somebody else's testimony, you cross-examine them. You know, you pursue the facts, the truth of the case. And if there is conflicting evidence and conflicting testimony, and there clearly was here, because all we heard from the prosecutor last night was the opposite of the story you just described. If there is conflicting testimony, that's why you have a trial. So that's why you should have an indictment. George, thank you for the call. We'll be back. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I was just talking with George about the eyewitness testimony that indicated that Michael Brown had been was standing with his hands up versus the eyewitness testimony that suggested that he was charging at the police officer Wilson. The prosecutor last night, when he did his sales pitch on national television, presented basically a defense, what Shane Farnan, our associate producer, referred to as a defense closing argument, or I would say a defense brief or whatever. They presented the defense's case, the defense of Officer Wilson. And frankly, that's not a prosecutor's job. A prosecutor's job is to present the prosecution's case. And if it's strong enough, or if there's any conflict in that, I mean, if you've got one person saying he was standing there with his hands up and you got another person, and I saw it, and, which makes it murder, and you got another person saying, no, he was charging at this police officer, even as the guy was shooting at him, he was coming at him like, you know, a bull toward a matador or something, and the shooting was therefore justified. When you've got two different people saying two different things that are that contradictory, that's when you have a trial. That's why, you know, the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution, that's why you have a trial before a jury of your peers, so that the evidence can be presented and the evidence can be examined. And the people making the testimony, I mean, the prosecutor, again, has implied, if not come right out and said, that some of the people who were giving exculpatory testimony, who were saying, you know, excuse me, not exculpatory, the people who were saying that, exculpatory to Michael Brown, because essentially he was being put on trial here. The people who were saying that the police officer was not just, Officer Wilson was not justified in ultimately killing this young man, should have had an opportunity to do so before in a public court of law, my opinion. And therefore, there should have been an indictment. Now, you know, there wasn't, and in part there wasn't because there almost never is when you're talking about a police officer shooting a civilian. And that has to do with part of that, some of that, has to do with the race of the races of the people involved, and some, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that prosecutors live and breathe police. I mean, they work side by side with police. A prosecutor could never do their job without a good relationship, a good working relationship with the police department. And when that prosecutor then decides to take on a police officer and prosecute that person, I mean, that could be the end of their career. It could be the, you know, it's just. Imagine, I mean, in the workplace, if you were to, I think this is one of the reasons why so rarely do people make charges like, you know, I've been sexually harassed or something, unless it reaches some incredible threshold, because, you know, they don't want to poison the workplace, as it were, or they value their job. I'm kind of wandering around here in my thinking. I'm still processing this myself. Patricia in Sacramento. Hey, Patricia, your thoughts.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Tom, God, there's so many emotions involved in this case. And first, to begin with, I find that in our country, we just have a violent society to begin with. You know, we incarcerate more people than any other industrialized country in the world. If a black male, especially if they're African-American, if a black male is caught doing crack, I've seen young ones, you know, 14, they're put in prison for 10 years. Whereas in a white-collar crime, you know, like Jamie Dimon, doesn't go to prison. So we know these things exist, but I'm concerned about a lot of these African-American communities because, like you mentioned, Tom, there's no investment on the part of our government to ensure that these schools that are located in poverty areas have everything they need. Investment in the inner city so we can get the youth off the streets and doing something constructive. I don't know, Tom. God, there's so many things. You know, I could just go on, and I'm sure you've already mentioned all this. But at the same time, Tom, what I believe as a parent, that in the African-American communities, the parents also need to step up to the plate to ensure that their youth is safe, meaning,
I'm sorry, Patricia.
You know,
that,
why is your kid roaming the
streets? Wait a second. Wait. This you have wandered into the realm of blaming the victim.
No. I'm not blaming the parent. He did not deserve what he got. This incident is due to a lack of officer training. We have too many police officers that kill first and ask questions.
It is due to a lack of police officer training. It is due to poverty, which is the consequence of institutional racism.
I mean, these are the main problems. But at the same time, what I'm suggesting, Tom, is parents like me, like you, that we also need to step up to the plate and ensure that we know what are our kids doing.
Patricia, I am the parent of three children who are all adults now. And throughout their lives, I never had to sit any one of my three children down and say, here's how you interact with the police. I never had that conversation with any of my kids. My friend Joe Madison on this program has talked on several occasions about how he had to have that conversation with every one of his kids. There is a really substantial difference in the experience, the parenting experience, and the growing up experience of people of different races in this country. And we have to acknowledge that. But. You know, that's not to say, I mean, I'm not saying that black parents should be having that conversation. I'm saying that they should never have to have that conversation.
Right.
And we can't, we can't lay this on parents. It's this, even the parents of Officer Wilson. I mean, this is something that has infected the society of this country since its creation. I mean, when Europeans first came to this country and initiated a genocide against Native Americans and then started importing, bringing in people from Africa as slaves, these two crimes drenched this country in blood and are continuing to this day. Patricia, thank you for the call. I think I get what you're trying to say. We'll be back coming up on the top of the first hour here. Your thoughts, my thoughts, you know, I guess Officer Wilson was not a ham sandwich. What can I say? We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I just posted over at conversationswithgreatminds.com the extended conversation I had Friday night with Brad Friedman and Greg Pallast about voter suppression and the Republican Party. I think it's one of the – I think it's a very important conversation, and I just wanted to recommend that you check that out. So apropos of, it has nothing to do with the Michael Brown issue, in a way it does, because it has to do with how we control our political space. Chuck Schumer this morning gave this incredible speech about strong, clear, and achievable Democratic pro-government plan would motivate the Democratic base and win over the working class. He says, let's review the history since 1932. He says, a pro-government mentality dominated politics from 1932 to 1980, and then everything changed. And he's suggesting we should go back to pre-1980. I'm with him on that. But back to the whole Michael Brown verdict, this is a very serious issue. Claire in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Claire, thanks for listening to the mic. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I'm very disturbed by this whole thing, too. And, of course, we just heard about this transcripts content today. But what always bothered me was why this officer didn't start with a taser, a stun gun, or pepper spray. And then today we find out that he testified to the grand jury, first of all, that there was only one, I forget if it was taser or stun gun, one for the whole police force, which I find extremely hard to believe, and that, two, he said he didn't like to have it with him because it wasn't comfortable to wear. And I just find that outrageous.
Yeah. Excellent point. Point taken. I agree. Claire, thank you for making that point. Mark Taylor Canfield on the line from Seattle. You were there with the protests in Seattle last night?
Mark? Actually, we were marching around with hip-hop artist Macklemore. And when I interviewed him about why he was there, he just kept repeating the same statement. I'm here to give Michael Brown. I'm here for Michael. That's all he would say. But he ended up using flashbang grenades and pepper spray in Seattle. There was a contingent of folks, including Macklemore, who headed down to Interstate 5 and tried to get on the freeway. Well, a few people worried about B-Way, so with pretty quick watch control, the Seattle Police Department decided at that point crowd control measures, and that included these kind of, they're sort of like stun grenades. They're very, very loud.
Flashbangs.
Blow your hearing if you stand next to them.
Right.
And they also put out a big flash that, kind of frightens people away. But there was another confrontation up at 12th and Pike with about 200 people against a bunch of riot cops there. But the police at that point made a good decision and decided to just walk away, and that totally dispersed the crowd.
Hmm.
But I think you know, Tom, here in Seattle, the Department of Justice did a 8-month investigation of the Seattle Police Department and found a practice and policy of the use of excessive force and also profiling. So this issue is very, very important right. to folks in Seattle, and especially since the killing of the Native American woodcarver a couple of years ago, John T. Williams.
Yeah. Well, and this raises this larger issue of who will police the police, to paraphrase the old one of actually several old cliches. And we don't have a good system for that in the United States, clearly. And we've got to do something. Mark, thank you for the report from Seattle. Appreciate it. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Tom, I've been thinking about the police kind of being out of control with shooting unnecessarily for years now. And what I come up with is maybe it should be charged as a civil rights violation automatically whenever the police shoot someone, and let the United States Department of Justice investigate it and dismiss the charges if it's obvious that the man was shooting at the police to begin with. Well, then the charges are dismissed. Right. But if you shoot the man because you're too lazy to pull out a baton and hit him, well, then you go to jail.
Yeah. Well, this gets back to my thing of who's going to police the police, because
the United States Department of Justice.
But see, there's
take it out of the hands of the locals.
Murder's not a federal crime.
No, but civil rights violation is, and whenever you shoot somebody, you certainly are violating their civil rights.
I understand that, and that's, you know, the Justice Department is looking into that right now with regard to this Michael Brown case, and we'll see where that goes. But we shouldn't be living in a country where the federal government has to be the one who polices our police. We really can't
let the local people police the police, because the local people would be corrupted by local politics every time. You need somebody outside the system.
Well, that's a good point, but perhaps it could be done within the state. Well, okay, no, you're building a good case, Ed. Let me chew on that one for a while. Let me think about that. Thank you for the call, Kathy in Lynn, Massachusetts. Hey, Kathy.
Hi, it's Catherine. Tom.
Catherine.
Good morning. Good afternoon. I stayed up. I want people to know that they can watch live coverage online at www.digg.com. And if they Google, there's a lot of other live websites that go up. So I saw things and some perspectives that I don't think anybody's talking about. As a young reporter said last night, when you see the violence and the people who tune in only for that and the media who do it, that's riot porn.
Yeah.
What I got to see were the small moments in between, what people were saying, how they felt. And one of the things nobody's really talked about is how many white kids are there. And when you have white activists, you also have white anarchist activists. And, you know, in the past, they've turned peaceful demonstrations violent more than once, and it's really only a few. Now, I'm not saying there wasn't a black person who was doing that, but it certainly wasn't talked about.
Are you saying that Catherine, are you saying that watching live streaming coverage I'll use the word riot for lack of a better word, of the last night that you saw provocateurs or people taking action, you know, igniting things who were white?
I didn't see them do it. I'm saying that there were many white people there.
Okay.
And that the first time around during August when I watched it live, there were white provocateurs there, young
yeah.
people,
yeah.
anarchists,
yeah.
that people tried to stop.
Yeah, and this has been a problem with the, you know, Occupy kinds of things also, the so-called black bloc folks who think that the way
right.
to change things is to burn down buildings, and it's not.
I also saw them throw tear gas canisters into the media area and into the streets beyond the street they were on.
Mm-hmm.
Canisters easily could have hit windows. I mean, I didn't see that.
Right.
They lied and said they were smoke bombs at first. Then they admitted that they were tear gas canisters.
They being the police?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And then they backed off on it later.
Right.
They closed two church safe spaces somewhere around 1 in the morning. They said to leave, but the exits were blocked by the police, and one of them was blocked by burning cars. It just there were things going on that nobody reported. Like you said, the small moments in between. You know, I saw the kids in the safe space in the basement, you know, taking care of their tear gas burns.
Wow.
And I didn't see many black people at 2 in the morning. I saw a few. I saw many white kids at 2 in the morning.
It's interesting. This concept of riot porn, it's fascinating because that's, you know, it seems to be what the media is obsessed with. Thank you for adding that to my vocabulary, Catherine. Thanks for the call and for sharing your perspective and what you've seen. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
How do we fix this country? I think it's a question we need to be asking. Welcome back. Lynn. Whoop, hang on just a second here. Lynn in Franklin, Maine, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
Hi. Well, I heard one of your guests this morning mention how it was no coincidence that no indictment was announced on the holiday weekend when it was cold, and to try and limit the number of people who may protest. And I agree with that, but I also want to say I feel like this is orchestrated to get the optics of kind of placating the closet bigots across the country by showing at night when it's scary, fires that are scary, and they clearly anticipated.
Oh, there's a storyline here, Lynn, that this prosecutor was laying out last night. It's basically black people gone wild, and
right,
that was Michael Brown, and that now that we're going to talk about that, now watch what happens on the street as we make this announcement at, you know, after sundown, you know, fairly early in the evening, you know, early enough for people to not be under curfew and to be out on the streets. I mean, it was as if this prosecutor wanted this to happen. I mean, he could have waited.
Exactly.
He could have waited until we were talking yesterday about this. They could have waited until Wednesday, Wednesday when people are preparing for Thanksgiving. I mean, they could have done it even on Thursday, I suppose.
Right. And I watched the live coverage last night, and they clearly anticipated there may be problems, saying they were going to call in the National Guard, yet there were no police at all on Florissant last night. There were no fire trucks. They let the buildings burn for over 15 minutes before the fire trucks were even called in my opinion, for maximum optics.
Yeah, it's riot porn. It's what Catherine was saying.
Right.
And this is the new fascination of the media, and it feeds this storyline that you watch Fox News, you get this storyline, you listen to Right Wing Talk Radio, you'll get this storyline. You know, it's black people gone wild, and it's
really disgusting.
It is. It's frankly, you know, it's a crime against democracy as well as humanity. Lynn, thank you for the call. Benjamin in Madison, Mississippi. Hey, Benjamin.
How are you doing? I appreciate being on Free Speech TV. Let's give it a try and see if it's the concept
that
works. You know, there were several things I was wanting to speak on, but when this guy earlier compared this to Emmett Till, I mean, that just really offended me.
Well, he wasn't comparing it to Emmett Till. What he said was that the picture of Emmett Till woke the nation up.
Yeah. And so you're going to compare a kid sleeping in his bed, you know, dragged out, beaten, thrown in a river, tied to a cotton gin, to a person who just was caught on tape stealing from a store. The police respond, and witnesses say he attacked the policeman going for his gun, and the policeman defended himself. And not one person has said anything about, you know, the right of a policeman. How many policemen are killed with their own gun in this country? Hundreds. And who are they? And that's people taking their guns off of them and killing them.
Benjamin, you make a strong case if the witnesses who are making that case, that's what happened, what you just described, are right. There are other witnesses who say that they're not right, and that's why there should be a trial. That's why there should be an action in court before a jury, not this song and dance that happened before the grand jury. We'll be back. Climb this past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Tom, I tried to watch that announcement unbiased last night, but what I heard was when you're given jury instructions, the jury's instructed that if a witness is false in one part of the testimony, the witness is to be distrusted in others. And I heard that replayed as, if any witness gives false testimony, you must assume that all witnesses may give false testimony. So they created doubt, and they created linkage. And even though I tried to be unbiased, it seems like I heard a lot of emphasis of the people lying about the actions that would have condemned Officer Wilson, and yet I heard almost no embellishment of the testimony of those, defending Michael. That's my take. That's just what I heard last night.
Well, that was my point. It was a defense summary. It was a defense closing argument.
I agree with you totally.
And
I agree with you totally what you were saying.
And it's understandable that somebody who works with the police department day in, day out, all the time, and requires the cooperation and goodwill of the police department in order to do his job, is going to, just by virtue of human nature, is going to have a certain bias toward the police. And that's why there should, instead of doing this and the grand jury itself, which, you know, these people are impaneled sometimes for months or years even, same people sitting there day after day or week after week, and getting to know the police officers, and they're going to have a bias toward the police as well. That said, I mean, none of us know what actually happened. We don't know if Officer Wilson was absolutely in the right, absolutely in the wrong, or some totally different place in the middle. And we don't know that because we have not had a trial. There has not been there were a series of witnesses who were presented before the grand jury. But when you read the transcripts, the prosecutor is not acting like a prosecutor. The prosecutor is actually leading some of these witnesses in the ways that a defense attorney would. And in fact, in a way that probably a prosecutor would object to if a defense attorney was trying to do that to somebody on the stand. So, you know, I'm not saying that there's absolute guilt or innocence on either side. What I'm saying is that I think that we should have had a judicial process, and that requires some sort of an indictment. Bill, thank you for the call. Josh in South Pasadena, California. Hey, Josh, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I agree with what you're saying about there definitely should have been an indictment, and there definitely is institutional racism. However, I think it's important not to mix up the entire idea of institutional racism with this isolated case. I mean, there were like eight witnesses that corroborated with the policeman's account, and eight of them were actually eight black witnesses that corroborated with the police account, but they did not want to be named because of fear of retribution. And I think it's important that you mentioned one thing about you didn't have to tell your kids about how to act with the police officer. Well, I'm white, my dad's white, and we've all been told how to act with a police officer. We're in the Los Angeles area, and I've gotten cops coming up to my car door with their hands on their guns. I know not to question the police officer. I know not to put my hands where they shouldn't be. I put my hands down on my lap. I don't hide them. You know, this is something that everybody knows around here.
Well, Josh, maybe it's because I grew up. Well, actually, I was speaking about my kids. I mean, my kids grew up 30 years ago, 20. They were in their teens 20 years ago, or 15 years ago. And, maybe it was a different time. Maybe it was a different place. Maybe it was where we lived. But I think that generally speaking, the experience, and I really believe this to be true, and it's consistent with everything that I've heard from person after person after person, is that by and large, black parents have to talk with their kids, have to raise their kids to know that the police represent a threat to them. Even if they're, perfectly, Rhodes scholars, and that by and large, white parents don't have to raise their kids to say the police are a threat to you. And that's George in Chicago. Hey, George, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm as disappointed as I can be in the decision not to indict for all the points that have been raised by you and the callers and your guests. They've made it clear that this is something that should have been adjudicated. I'm disappointed in the governor for failing to appoint a special prosecutor, and disappointed that the case was not moved out of St. Louis County to another part of the state. The prosecutor made the point that this grand jury was not picked in the heat of the moment, that it had been sitting since May 15th. But based on what I've heard so far in your show, that means they had plenty of time to get comfy and familiar with the police and the prosecutor.
Correct.
So he basically had a known quantity on his hands. What I would really like to see and have almost no hope of seeing is that President Obama meets with Attorney General Holder and says, for the good of the country, I need you to rescind your resignation, because we need an attorney general in place to make a thorough investigation of everything that happened here, and that every relevant.
Well, I believe Eric Holder is still the attorney general. His resignation is contingent on a replacement, and so he's.
If that's true, but I would like to see the attorney general say that the presence of an unquestioned attorney general who's going to serve out the entire term to the end of Obama's presidency will mean that there won't be any hearings in the Senate to take away from the fact that the attorney general needs to be in place and focused on doing an investigation which might result in a federal civil rights case against the officer for killing the
George, I understand your point, but just point of reality here. The attorney general would not be the person doing this anyway. It would be somebody appointed by the attorney general. This is something that they kick down the food chain, and then the attorney general is the guy who comes out and says, "Here's what we decided." And he's a cabinet officer. He's got a million things on his plate, and really big, serious things. Which is not to say that this is not a big, serious thing, but virtually everything that the AG's office does is done by somebody other than the AG himself. But your point is well taken, George. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We'll be back with more right after this break. Minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to the second hour of our program. And Lynn in John Day, Oregon. Hey, Lynn. What's on your mind?
Well, according to the Justice Department, about 500 innocent Americans are murdered by police every year. And it's interesting, in Utah, there was a black officer who killed a white kid because he looked like a suspect that they were looking for, and the kid refused to get down. He's like, hey, you know, he didn't have a gun on him, nothing. That officer was immediately disciplined. Whereas, you know, in the South, Darren Wilson gets away with it.
I don't have personal knowledge of that double standard case, but and I would be very careful about saying that according to the Justice Department, 500 people are murdered by police every year, because murdered means somebody has, you know, committed a crime. And
well, I mean, they're killed by police every year.
Yeah, killed is the appropriate word, and that's, I mean, that. At a certain level, I mean, we need to kind of amp down some of this conversation, because tragically, sometimes killing people is part of the job of being a police officer. And I don't think it's only a sociopath would enjoy that or look forward to that. But, you know, although we glorify it like crazy in all our cop shows and you know, all television movies and everything else. But anyway, but your interesting point, Lynn, and thank you for the call. Robert in Wilmington, North Carolina. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind?
I was thinking about the situation, and I used to work for a DA's office, so I have a little bit of firsthand experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the underlying problem is a lack of trust in the system, because even if the evidence would have shown that Officer Wilson did the correct action, I don't think that would have, you know, that doesn't suffice for the people that are angry, because they don't have any trust in the process and the system.
Right.
So it really, we can debate the facts of this one case all day long, but it's not going to fix the problem.
I agree, and that's why I'm not debating the facts of the case. That's why I'm, you know, I've said right up front several times today, I have no idea what happened, and nobody else does either, because we have conflicting witnesses offering conflicting accounts, and even the police officer has given conflicting testimony that conflicts with his own previous testimony. And that's why you have trials. That's why you impanel a jury of your peers and you appoint a prosecutor and a defense lawyer, and you go at it. You dig out the truth, and you have an impartial jury that is impaneled specifically for that purpose, for that trial, figure this out. And that is a very different process from the grand jury process, where you've got a group of people who have been sitting there since May, for what's that, 5 months now, interacting on a regular basis with all of the members of the police department and this particular prosecutor, and you know, getting all friendly and chummy with them, and then, you know, and then the prosecutor comes to them and basically says, let's look for the reasons why we should let this guy go. And at least that's how, and I have not read even. Well,
there is a relationship there, and it doesn't matter. You know, I've heard, you know, colleagues or other prosecutors that have said, well, you know, we've even prosecuted police officers. However, that is the exception to the rule. That is something
right.
that doesn't happen very often. And when you work as a prosecutor, you know, police officers are your investigators, they're your witnesses, they're your friends, they're people that you work with on a daily basis. And if you've ever looked at the game theory in political science, you know, when you have to have an ongoing relationship with someone and there's a negative action, you're less likely to do that action because you're worried about what's going to happen tomorrow.
Right.
So we have to have a system to where when a law enforcement officer kills a citizen or there's a shooting, you know, whatever threshold we decide to set of the people, that there is a separate system for them to go to before it goes to court.
I agree. And this is
the grand jury process, because court is a long, drawn-out, expensive and damaging process. Even if you're innocent,
right.
until you get that trial, life is very difficult.
Yes.
So I believe in the grand jury process. However, when you're a member of law enforcement, you should be under the understanding that this is going to be a different process for me, that it needs to be out in the open, that there needs to be a protection of witnesses. However, the record needs to be open,
right.
and that it needs to be done by somebody that is completely and totally independent of the local system.
Agreed. And this is where, you know, from what I read in the New York Times this morning, New York State struggled with this. And sometime in the late 1980s, actually passed a law that created kind of a special prosecutor's office. There was a name for it. I'm forgetting what it was right now, but they created the special prosecutor's office that oversaw police misconduct cases, not just limited to police shootings, but, you know, police stealing property from people, police assaulting people, whatever. And it was defunded in 1990. The legislature did away with it. And I suspect that there's a really interesting story in there somewhere. And one of the things that I hope, you know, we can do over the next week or so is track down how that got started and how it blew up, why it didn't work. Because we need, as you say correctly, Robert, and I totally agree, we need in this country some kind of a process where people will know that when X says, I was going to say when a grand jury says, but the grand jury obviously isn't the process, that when the authorities say, when the government says, we are quite certain now that this police officer did no wrong, that you can believe it, that you can rely on it, that it's a credible statement. And we don't have that right now, pretty much anywhere in this country. And that's a problem, particularly for people whose communities are in frequent conflict with the police for a whole variety of reasons. That's a whole nother conversation. Robert, thank you for the call. Very well said. Kayla in Sugar Land, Texas. Hey, Kayla, what's up?
Hey, okay. So my main issue with the community and with society's response to what's going on in Ferguson is they're bringing up black-on-black crime. They're using the term black on black crime.
Who is?
And what I'd really like for people, just society, people that I've come into contact with, they're saying things like, we're mad about Darren Wilson, killing Mike Brown, but we're ignoring the high rates of black on black crime within the black community. And that is not the point. That has absolutely nothing to do.
That has nothing to do with anything, Kayla. You're right. And if you're talking about Rudy Giuliani's comments over the weekend, I mean, that in my opinion, that's, he's just exhibiting good old fashioned racism. The fact of the matter is that there's white on white crime. I mean, people tend to commit crimes in the neighborhoods that they live in, and
but it doesn't even matter. There is no such thing as black on black crime. There is civilian crime against other civilians.
Yes.
And then there is police brutality, which black people are most often subject to.
Yes.
That's the problem.
Yes, I agree. Well said. Thank you very much. Absolutely. Dick in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Dick, what's up?
Tom, you made a good point. You know, I like your ideology about this crime, you know, versus democracy, you know. But this justice system, I'm just somewhat puzzled by this, Tom.
Okay.
About what happened, you know. I just don't think the man should have got off.
I'm not saying that Officer Wilson should be in jail or not. I'm saying that if you have conflicting eyewitness testimony,
yes,
then that's why you put people in front of, that's why you have a trial. That's why you appoint a prosecutor and a defense attorney.
That's why you have a trial, right.
And in this case, this prosecutor did not play the role of a prosecutor. If you read the transcripts that he put out, he's leading witnesses in the way that a defense attorney would. And it's a broken process. It's just
broken
process. Dick, thank you for the call. Carl in Saginaw, Michigan. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to respond to just one thing you said earlier. There's just so much that's been said, but this one thing that ignited me was you said that you grew up in the 70s during the Civil Rights Movement. And I wanted to just share something with you. I grew up, went to a segregated high school, grew up partially in the segregated South, mm-hmm. marched with Martin Luther King in both marches in Memphis, Tennessee, and was a part of that movement, labor movement in Memphis. And what I wanted to share with your listeners and yourself is that when they say, this one officer says that he was in a dangerous neighborhood, and I think, you know, we see the black neighborhood as being dangerous. Blacks don't. They see it as, you know, a necessity where we have to live. Where we see danger is when we go to the white community,
right,
where we're profiled, where we're immediately different.
Right.
And it makes us uncomfortable in America itself. And the other thing I wanted to share with you is that now that I've lived through all that and I'm looking around, I've come to understand we live in a country of laws, but you cannot legislate a heart. And I think that not all whites in America, I'm not generalizing, but for the most part, there is a movement in America that is from a very sick heart.
Carl, I agree. And we need to have a healing. Carl, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
America's soul is sick. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom in Salinas, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, I'm thinking that we need to move the conversation towards systemic change on the way that police deal with the civilians. I think this whole Ferguson thing is hijacked into a race issue, and it should be recognized for what it is. It's a police issue. And some of your earlier callers have hit on the fact that we need a federal response to this because of the parochial nature of all the police forces.
Right.
If you have a bus and it crashes and people are hurt, you investigate the driver.
Right. So
if there's a federal response, something as monumental as maybe the Miranda rights or something, that there always has to be an investigation anytime there's a shooting.
So you're suggesting that, like, the NTSB, for example, the National Transportation Safety Board, whenever there is a commercial vehicle, you know, if a 18-wheeler goes off the road, I believe the NTSB has to be at least notified, and typically there's an investigation of some sort. If an airplane crashes or even, you know, loses a landing gear or something, the NTSB gets brought in, that there be and that's all specific to the realm of transportation, that in the realm of policing, there be an equivalent to the NTSB, a federal investigative agency that issues findings, determining, you know, how something happened and why something happened. And then those findings can be used, you know, for example, if the NTSB determines that, you know, this truck accident, this horrible accident that happened where this, you know, commercial vehicle killed a bunch of people or whatever because the driver was intoxicated, then the local officials have the basis for a prosecution. Or if, on the other hand, if they determine, hey, it was just, you know, it was one of those stuff happens, or it was, you know, black ice on the road and they went sliding or something like that, you didn't see it, then there's a basis for an acquittal, as it were. Am I making sense here, Tom? Is that what you're suggesting?
That is what I'm getting at. I heard early media in August giving, you know, toxicology reports. They checked the victim, Michael Brown. I never heard anything about the officer. My first impression was that you have somebody who snapped or possibly on PCP, the officer.
Right. Yeah, well, the fact is we don't know. I have not gone through all of the now the prosecutor, Bob McCullough, has released, you know, much, if not most, maybe all of the testimony before the grand jury. And I haven't looked through it thoroughly enough to know if, for example, a tox screen was done on Officer Wilson after the shooting. Presumably,
yes,
it was. I'm, you know, I mean, he was.
I wouldn't presume that for a second.
Well, he was in a hospital and he took his picture.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, maybe you're right. I just don't know. But the question of an independent, non-political, non-parochial, you know, non-local review board for police misconduct, I think is a really, really good idea for us all to be talking about. Tom, thank you for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And where did Luke go? Oh, he's on Skype. Luke Vargas with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hey, Luke.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So you're at the UN?
I'm actually in London. I've just got back from Tunisia last night, covering the presidential elections there.
Holy cow. So what's going on in Tunisia?
Well, things, not much at the moment, actually. Over the weekend, they held their first democratically elected presidential vote. It was, by all accounts, a pretty successful endeavor.
Tunisia is the country where the Arab Spring began. Is that correct? Where the street vendor set himself on fire?
Exactly right. And, you know, going there and spending about 4 days there talking to people, it was pretty, it really helped me understand why so many commentators very early on in the Arab Spring were talking about this movement across the Arab world with so much excitement, because things really did go very smoothly in Tunisia during the Jasmine Revolution, which was peaceful when the police did not open up and fire on protesters. And after Ben Ali resigned, you had an Islamist party called Ennahda come into power. This is sort of similar to what happened in Egypt, where after so many years of being repressed, being forced to be basically a civic organization, Muslim Brotherhood tried its hand at politics. Unlike in Egypt, though, where after a year or about a year, the military just pulled the plug on the experiment, said they had enough and launched that coup. In Tunisia, the Ennahda party was in power. They helped shepherd through a new constitution. They compromised on a number of items, such as abandoning Sharia law in the constitution, such as allowing provisions to come through that provided equal rights for men and women, equal representation as a goal in parliament and in the workforce for women. They lost elections last month simply because, you know, it's hard to govern in this post-revolution space. They didn't have the experiment ended prematurely. They just basically lost a little bit of popularity and a more moderate, secular and modernist coalition called Nida Tunes, or the Call for Tunisia, has come into power and is likely to win the presidential runoff, which will occur next month.
Right. Now, Tunisia is a country that we have not bombed yet, right?
That's correct.
That have something to do with why democracy seems to work there and it doesn't seem to work very well in Iraq and Afghanistan?
The argument I heard from people there was not that, that it actually goes back much further to the regime of Bourguiba in the middle of the 20th century. He was a dictator, but people still look on him quite fondly. They don't do that about Ben Ali, but his sort of ideological predecessor is seen in quite a good light still. He's seen as establishing a strong tradition of education in the country that's left the Tunisian population one of the most educated in the Arab world. He improved infrastructure. But what a lot of people said, cutting across different political parties even now, is that he instilled a sense of sort of national identity, so that even presently, when we have these strong debates between do we want a secular or a religious state, how do we want to define the roles for women, that these issues don't carry over into fighting. They carry over into a lively political discourse. At the end of the day, Tunisians, because of that strong national identity from the 20th century, are able to come together and settle these things in government, collectively. And you know, that's, you know, one of the reasons I think they haven't descended into the chaos of, for example, neighboring Libya.
Fascinating. I'm curious. Ukraine is making a big announcement about NATO membership. Do I have that right?
Yeah, we heard from Petro Poroshenko yesterday that he plans to hold a referendum in and out of NATO membership. It's worth noting that over the past few weeks, Vladimir Putin had been pressuring the Kiev regime to say they were going to commit against 100% joining up with NATO.
Right.
Another thing worth pointing out is that NATO doesn't have a strict criteria for joining, but it is sort of understood that you join NATO when you're able to contribute to collective security across the North Atlantic. At this point, I'm not sure if Ukraine really qualifies for that. They're still more of a problem than a problem solver.
Right.
That could change in the next 2 years.
Well, and George Herbert Walker Bush made a commitment to Mikhail Gorbachev that Ukraine would never join NATO, that there would always be that buffer there for Russia.
You're exactly right.
Yeah. So this is a tough one for the Russians. Finally, I'm curious, you're in London. How is the international press covering the situation in Ferguson?
Very little. It's a question I've been getting doing radio hits all day today.
Right.
It seems to be almost all of what domestic hosts in the U.S. can talk about. It hasn't really made a big impression here. I mean, there are stories in the sensational domestic media here all the time about racial incidents here in the United Kingdom. I think it doesn't really surprise people that those things are also occurring back in the States. There is some attention to it, I'm sure, because of the timing of when the violence and the looting happened last night and those dramatic pictures. It didn't really make it to press here. I'm sure in tomorrow's papers there'll be some of those photos in a nice colorful spread, but the timing of the news cycles didn't line up to make it quite as big of a story as it was in the United States, where everyone apparently is talking about why was this decision for the grand jury announcement scheduled to coincide with the nighttime when there could be that chance of rioting here. You know, it was early morning. The papers had already come out. I don't think it's going to have quite the same impact internationally as it has back in the States.
Right. Well, time will tell. I'm guessing that it's going to seep out because, I mean, we're just, you know, all of our networks are just wall to wall with this. And mostly it's Catherine, a caller earlier, called riot porn. They just, you know, seem obsessed with showing burning buildings. And it's just finally, the Iranian nuclear deal deadline has passed. What's going on with Iran and the possibility of our working something out with them?
Yeah, the deadline passed. We're going to extend for another 7 months. That's not really a surprise to me or other the people in this sort of foreign policy reporting sphere. We've been hearing rumblings of that for quite some time. I think what surprised me, though, was listening to these remarks by both Hassan Rouhani, the president of Iran, and the foreign minister, Javad Zarif, right after it was sort of announced that there wasn't going to be a deal. Hassan Rouhani, obviously the guy in charge of looking at the balance sheet, he wants, among other things, the sanctions to be lifted. He wants Iran to be able to produce oil like it used to be able to. I think about 1 million barrels a day at peak production. You know, they apparently need gas prices to be high in order to balance their own budget. Right. The gas prices might not recover as quickly, but production could, and that would really help them out. So there's perhaps that's the reason he has seemed a little bit more conciliatory and is saying there's not such an ideological gap between the West and Iran. Right. The foreign minister, maybe more of an ideologue, is holding firm, doesn't want to cede any ground. For him, oil's not the top priority. It's the reputation and the rights of Iran to do what it wants to do.
Right. Got it. Well, Luke Vargas for the Talk Radio News Service, live from London. Thank you, Luke.
Sure thing.
Good talking. We'll be back. Jesse Ventura is going to drop by, and we'll continue with our conversation about what's going on in Ferguson. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And somebody earlier had called in and asked if Darren Wilson had been tested for drugs. Shane has been, as we've been going through the program, has been going through the all the information that the prosecutor released, and we found his drug test. And, yes, he was tested for drugs. He tested negative for cocaine, amphetamines, marijuana, opiates, and phencyclidine, PCP, I think that is. But he tested very, very high for creatinine. In fact, it was 331 was the count. Very, very high. I believe that's something that is banned in like Olympic sports and things. It's used by bodybuilders. I could be wrong, though. But Jesse Ventura might know, and he also might know a lot about a lot of other things as well. I've got a bunch of questions for him. Jesse Ventura, the former governor of Minnesota, the host of Aura TV's new online political talk show, Off the Grid. That's aura.tv/off the grid. Governor Ventura, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here. If I could back up a little, I want to back you up that, I live half the year off the grid down in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And I want to tell you that the thing on dual languages, more intelligence, is absolutely true because I'm very fluent in both English and slang.
There you go. For people who not everybody hears our newscast, so that's a story that was in our newscast during the break at the top of the hour. Some stations insert their own. I'm curious.
Actually, Tom, let me add my dog takes orders fluently in German, French, and English.
Very good. It's probably responding to tone of voice, right? I'm curious. We originally booked you to talk about legalizing pot and about the 2016 elections, and I want to get your thoughts on those things. But the topic that has overtaken the show and overtaken the day is what's happening in Ferguson. And one of the things that concerns me and has concerned a lot of our listeners and viewers is that when you have a prosecuting attorney who works hand in glove with the police, and in fact, his job, his the success of his job depends on a good working relationship with the police. And when you have a grand jury that's been impaneled since May, as this one was in Ferguson, and has every day been working with the police, and they get to know each other and they work together, and there's an inherent just kind of human nature bias in there against going against one of your own, you know, against. So, how do we hold police departments accountable or individual police officers when they may have committed a crime or may not have? How do we determine that in a way that everybody will trust? Everybody will say, no, this is not a rigged system. This actually works. What are your thoughts on this? You were the governor of Minnesota. I mean, you certainly.
Well, I was also a mayor, too, of the sixth largest city of Minnesota, Brooklyn Park.
Okay, so
I actually have 8 years' experience, 4 as a mayor, 4 as a governor. I'll state this. I believe they should have, not even knowing the evidence, just the situation and what it's turned into, he said, she said, we're all getting different accounts of what happened. Nobody really knows what the truth is. I would have think they should have indicted for at least manslaughter to have a trial, because nothing's official until you go to court in a trial with a prosecutor and a defense lawyer.
That's what I've been saying for 2 hours
here. And so they could have avoided all of this problem now, simply allowing the system to go. Have a trial.
Yeah.
If the guy's innocent, look, I just went through it, Tom, with this horrible thing with this Chris Kyle, the Navy SEAL that wrote this fabricated chapter about me in a book.
Hmm.
And I went to trial over it because I knew it didn't happen, and I prevailed.
Yeah.
You know, because I used the system. Why didn't they allow the system to work here? Now we're going to have suspicion all the way.
Yeah. And
you'll never get above it. Why not have a trial? That's why we have the system. Then things will be entered into court. Nothing is official till they're put into a courtroom.
Right. I'm with you. You were a professional athlete at one point in time. What does a high creatinine level mean? Is that of consequence?
I'm not sure.
Okay. All right.
It could be those drinks, you know.
Yeah.
They got these power drinks out there now that I certainly wouldn't drink them. And I think too many young people are drinking them. They're all hopped up with stuff, to these energy drinks. And I'm only speculating.
Yeah.
But I would assume those energy drinks are probably high in that creatine.
Yeah, and the low end of what you normally would find in somebody's blood is a count of 20, and Officer Wilson was 331.2. So.
Well, the thing is, that with a drink like that, it's going to get right into your system. And, you know, if it's an energy drink, I assume you'll get a big flush of energy.
Yeah, which might not be the very best thing, given the circumstances. But who knows? I mean, this is all speculation.
I couldn't honestly answer it for you, Tom.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thanks for taking a shot at it, though. I'm curious your thoughts on the 2016 elections. Chuck Schumer here in Washington, D.C. this morning gave what I thought was a startling and consequential speech, in which he basically said, he said, from 1932 until 1980, Americans trusted government and knew that government could build the middle class. And starting in 1980, with the Reagan Revolution, in quotes, Americans lost their faith in our government, and or even discarded faith in government. And that if the Democratic Party wants to start winning again, or anybody, they need to embrace populism, and they need to embrace the idea that government can be made to work for the average working person and not just for the banksters. What do you think?
They're setting the table for me if I want to run in 2016.
I think so.
They're opening the door. Because what was the voter turnout, 36%?
Yeah, in most of the country. Yeah, I mean, it was as high as 60%.
Nationwide was 36%.
Yeah.
That means they've alienated the majority. 64% now are choosing not to vote for Democrats or Republicans because they're so disgusted with it. They're waiting for me out there to embrace me, and guaranteed I'll steal some of their 36 because I did it in Minnesota. Yeah. I had less of a pot in Minnesota. Minnesota always leads the nation in voter turnout. In off elections, we actually get a pathetic 50%.
Oh, gee.
You know, it's still pathetic, but we lead the nation.
Yeah.
So I only had a pot of 50%. They're giving me a pot of 64 here. And if you allow me in the debates and give me ballot access in all 50 states, I'll tell you what I'd run on right now, Tom.
Okay.
And you're pretty savvy, and this would be the issue. Tell me if you think this would work today. I would run and give the people of America the opportunity to make history with me and elect the first president who doesn't belong to a political party since the father of our country, George Washington. I believe I could win on that alone, indulging these 64% to say, come on out and watch your vote count when you elect me.
Very interesting. You know, it's you look at what Rosh Perot did in 92, and John Anderson got, you know, a respectable bump prior to that, but that, in particular, Rosh Perot is running not just as I'm not them, but also, you know, I mean, Rosh Perot was running against so-called free trade and NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, all those things.
Right. But I think that issue alone right now with the sentiment in this country, I think people would jump at the chance to not elect a Democrat or Republican.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, George Washington, imagine that, Tom. He is the only president we've had.
Yeah, and arguably he was a Federalist, I mean, ultimately. But, yeah, you're right. We have just 30 seconds left, Governor. Your thoughts on legalizing pot?
Well, it's an industry waiting to create jobs. I'll give you the quick example. I know two people who suffered seizure disorders. Medical put them on four different medicines. None of them worked. They went to Colorado. They're on medicinal marijuana now, and they're not having seizures.
Wow.
And, I mean, what more do you need there?
There you go.
Only that, it's industry, it's jobs, it's food. Do you know that marijuana makes the best biodiesel fuel on the planet?
Yeah, hemp. Yeah. In fact,
why aren't we exploiting this? And for all the religious people out there, remember, God made it.
There you go. Governor Jesse Ventura, Aura.tv. Thank you, Governor.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with your calls and my thoughts and the news of the day. Stick around. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Ray in Van Buren, Arkansas. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's good to talk to you again. Yeah, I noticed in his presser, Prosecutor Bob McCullough, basically he was pigeonholing the eyewitness accounts that did not line up with Officer Darren Wilson's account. First thing I wanted to say is I did not hear him give equal credence to the possibility that there was a conflict in the accounts of the eyewitnesses that lined up with Darren Wilson's account, nor did I hear him say that even though he is a police officer, Officer Darren Wilson is nonetheless, he is an eyewitness. And because of that, and you hear people say that eyewitness accounts are unreliable, why do they not say that police officers are human, that they can be unreliable, and that their eyewitness account can be flawed as well? And what that's basically leading to is this. I've heard what Rudy Giuliani had to say. I was watching MSNBC, and I heard what he had to say. And I heard Rush Limbaugh, he scoffed at the idea of community policing, where you have proportional policing based upon the population. And so if Rudy Giuliani believes that police officers can always be trusted and that their, to lack of a better phrase, that their reliability is bulletproof, if that is the case, what problem would they have with community policing, where you have proportional representation? And to take it even further, what problem would they have if they trust police officers completely? What problem would they have in having a community that's predominantly white being policed by a police force that's predominantly black?
I wonder if there's any place in America where that is the case.
Why couldn't we have that? If police officers have near absolute trustworthiness, which is being ascribed to them.
Yeah. Well, I don't, you know.
What would be the problem of proportional representation on police forces?
Yeah, you're asking a rhetorical question based on a non-existent assumption.
Well, the point is that we have in America disproportional police representations like we do in Ferguson.
Right.
You have almost 70% African-American population, and you basically only have like about a 5% representation on the police force.
Right.
Well, what's the problem then with either A, having proportional representation where you have a near, where you have close to 60-70% African-American representation, which they do in many other cities across America. They are trying that out. They are trying proportional representation.
Yeah.
And what I think is that why, if that's the case, why couldn't you also have on the other end where you have predominantly white neighborhoods that would have a predominantly black police force? I wouldn't have any problem with either of them.
Yeah.
Personally, I would have no problem with either of them.
I think the back to your original point, the number one, police officers are eyewitnesses, but when a police officer is accused of a crime, they're also potentially a defendant. So you have to take their testimony in that context. And number two, you know, the assumption that Rudy Giuliani is making that police officers can always be trusted. I think it obviously it's not true, but they could be more trusted if they were better paid, well trained, and had a higher bar for recruitment. So we had a caller a little bit ago talking about Rudy Giuliani and how over the weekend he was at MSNBC and he was talking about how, you know, you can always trust the cops, right? The cops, they're always the good guys. His chief of police was Bernie Kerik, who is in prison right now. As Shana was pointing out to me just a moment ago, it's like, really? I'm surprised nobody pointed that out to him. Of course, that would have been kind of embarrassing to say to him while he's on TV. Bob in Ashland, Oregon. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good.
Yeah, first of all, I looked up creatine while I was waiting, and it's basically a supplement that's used to help build muscle mass, and it's okayed by the Olympic Committee as well as
oh, it is.
NCAA.
Okay, so this is not something that would hop up an officer.
Not according to the side effects, so from the WebMD.
Okay.
But mostly I was calling because I was kind of interesting. Your first caller brought up, you know, was talking about protesting and stuff. But what I haven't heard anybody talk about is that we still have the capacity to change government through voting. And we had an incredibly low turnout during the midterms. And so the people that were voting were mostly people, from what I could see, that tend towards authoritarian-type rule. And so when we get authoritarian-type actions, it's like, well, who's at fault? Us, for not voting, for not getting out there and getting the kind of people representing us that tend to be more rational and, you know, reflect the population of our country.
But that so said, how can you blame people for not voting when for 34 years now you have had an entire political party and politicians literally from the president on down, Ronald Reagan on down, saying directly to the American people that they cannot trust government. The government is the cause of their problems, not the solution to their problems. The predictable consequence of that would be the people would give up and quit participating.
Well, yeah, and that's the whole point of that strategy. And it's frustrating when there's so much pretty obvious examples of where voting does, you know, where we can make differences through voting.
Yeah.
You've talked about it. You know, almost every progressive ballot that was out there got passed.
Yep. And,
you know,
and,
there's a great example that we can change things through voting.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if people are going to go, you know, my thought is like, well, if you didn't vote, then your protest has a whole lot less value.
Or, you know, let's say if you are going to protest, the next step needs to be to make sure that you're registered to vote and that you participate in your local democracy.
Yes. Exactly.
Framing it as opportunity rather than as blame, because
exactly. Because
I think framing it as blame doesn't serve any good purpose. And also, you know, I think that there are reasons why people don't vote, and it's not that they're stupid. It's that they've been, like I said, for 34 years they've been told that there's no point in it, that it's a rigged game, that government doesn't work, that you know, just rely on the billionaires, they'll take care of you, they'll do everything for you, you know, et cetera,
right.
et cetera. And it's a very toxic message. Bob, good point. Yeah. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Larry in Catawba, Virginia. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Hey, I hope I can convey this thought that I have clearly and so you can follow it. I look at this thing of, going on in Ferguson, Missouri, and looking at it like in a broader scope, going back to the 60s with when you had President Kennedy and President Johnson, they had Democrats in the office, you had the Civil Rights Movement, and the attacks on the black community back then, and then now you have this in Ferguson, you have a Democrat in office again, and you have these attacks, and I look on it as that a lot of this stuff is instigated. I mean, from my viewpoint, there's been a lot of injustices done to the black community in our country, since slavery, consistently. And this stuff is instigated. I mean, I don't think it's by accident. This stuff is instigated, and you have this stuff going on, and it's the divide, the 99%, because it's like the Republicans use this in their, their strategy, like, well, you don't want to be a part of these, rioters or stuff like that. And it's an attack on our country as a whole, where they're trying to divide the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just this, just this weekend, there was a 12-year-old boy in Cleveland that was shot and killed by a police officer waving a toy gun.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're familiar with that story.
I am, yeah.
And the kicker of it is this stuff, I'm saying, like you're talking about the Koch brothers and their plot to buy the election. I say it may go up as high as that, where there's somebody instigating attacks on minorities, whether it be Latinos or blacks, causing trouble in those communities. And then if the Democratic Party, is the party that's like, well, this party here is standing up for these people, or this party here trying to help these people out, and they're bad, and it causes other people that should be voting more democratically to say, well, maybe I should.
What you're describing, Larry, is Richard Nixon's Southern strategy.
Exactly. And also this, Tom, that's exactly, I'm glad that we're on the same page.
Yeah.
I also
and Reagan, by the way, played that out, too. His first speech he gave as a candidate for president was in Philadelphia, Mississippi, right, on states' rights.
Right. And the other thing is, I don't want to sound like going full-blown coup conspiracy theory, but I also believe that there are people in power, financial power in this country, that think that if they can disrupt the government of this country to the point of even causing civil unrest or even insurrection, rebellion, that would be a good thing, because then they could come in and take over. Because if you look at the Civil War historically, the Civil War did not happen by accident.
Right.
It was brought on and coerced. I mean, I don't think the result of the Civil War is what the people that instigated it wanted.
Yeah, Larry, that's a whole other direction. Thank you for the call. Good point. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
It's the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more of your calls. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's 28 minutes before the hour. Interesting conversation with Governor Jesse Ventura, who said, when you have conflicting, in fact, this is the headline over at the New York Times. I was just during the break looking at the New York Times website. And the top headline on the top story is witnesses in Ferguson give differing accounts of what happened the day that Michael Brown was shot. Well, as I've been saying for a couple of hours, and as Governor Ventura said, that's why you have trials. Indicting somebody doesn't mean that they're guilty. It means that you're going to find out what happened. And that did not happen here. And I think that this is a miscarriage of justice, I think is the old phrase. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Tom. You know, that's interesting because we know from psychology that two witnesses that we know witness the same event will give different accounts of it.
Of course.
So, you know, that we know when we set them up in experimental, sitting them side by side and watch the same thing, that they will report different things. They would report that they saw different things.
The other thing that we know is that when somebody starts telling the story of something that they experienced, that they actually saw or they actually experienced, over time that story will change. And as the story change, and in particular the story can change as a consequence of people have engaging them in conversation about it, and as that story changes, that person's actual recollection changes. Right. Memory changes over time.
That's absolutely right, yeah. I have an interesting, or what seems interesting to me, observation about, because of this story in Ferguson has been, like everything else in our country, politicized right-left from really since the beginning. I have not heard a single conservative commentator question the actions of the Ferguson Police Department as in terms of the, you know, the protest, or Officer Darren Wilson himself. And so I started thinking, conservatives seem to have a problem with every part of government as being intrusive. You know, the IRS wants to verify that your 501c4 is legitimate. Oh, that's just a big scandal.
That's government tyranny. Intrusion.
Yeah, but every part of government is suspect, except the part of government that has the deadly force, the police.
Right.
And why? Well, who do the police deal with? They deal with the members of the community, mostly poor people, when you think about it. When it comes to the bank, the banksters and their bankster fraud. Oh no, that's too big to jail.
Right.
So that's the one thing. And another thing I wanted to mention was there's a new book out by a guy who writes, a conservative writer for the Wall Street Journal. His name is Brett Stevens. I can't remember the title of the book, but it talks about how us being the world's policemen militarily is a good thing. It's not a bad thing, because all neighborhoods, says he, need policing. And I actually had a chance to talk to him about that, and I asked him, how do you equate community policing with worldwide militarization? But what struck me was that people on the right think that policing is militarizing.
Right.
And you can see that in our police forces.
Right. This is a subset of the authoritarian worldview, the authoritarian mindset that John Dean wrote about so eloquently in his book Conservatives Without Conscience. And it seems to be that there's maybe even a genetic component to it. About 20% of us are authoritarians. And some authoritarians take charge, other authoritarians follow orders, but they're all part of that authoritarian mindset. And I agree with you. The irony is not lost on me. I cannot tell you how many times I've debated a conservative on the death penalty. And, you know, they're all, you know, I'll first start them out with a conversation about the post office. Oh, the post office is terrible. Or the IRS, oh, you can't try. They screw things up all the time. And they're taking your money. And the post office is losing things. And then I say, okay, so you want this same government that you don't trust and that is incompetent and that can't do anything right to be determining who's going to live and who's going to die?
Right.
And at that point, you know, typically they go, yeah.
yeah, of course.
And my head explodes.
Well, yeah, one further point that I came across was when we talked about what's the program again where the police forces are getting surplus military equipment. It's the
I don't remember the name of it either, but I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Okay, so this actually maybe started in the 1990s, but I think the precursor goes back further. I was reading about the Detroit riots of 1967. I'm from Detroit. I was there. And I know you were in Michigan at the time.
Yep.
Contrary to probably popular belief, the riot was not as widespread as most people believe. It was in a neighborhood.
No, it was six or eight city blocks.
Yeah, it was not citywide.
Yeah.
But at the time, then Governor George Romney asked President Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, to bring in the U.S. Army.
Right.
And President Johnson said, no, I can't do that unless you can prove or show that this is a genuine insurrection to overthrow the government.
Right.
Okay, well, he couldn't do that.
Right.
Okay, so I think National Guard troops were borrowed from somewhere else, like maybe Texas or something like that. And but it occurs to me that was probably the last time when when officials started thinking, well, if we can't bring in the U.S. Army, we better become the U.S. Army.
Hmm. That's interesting. It hadn't occurred to me, but the riots of the late 60s and my recollection is the early 70s, but I was living in Detroit in 72, so it must have been the late 60s.
It was in 67.
67, okay.
Yeah, 67 was the year that the Detroit riots, and I was going to school down in Detroit. I was doing my music conservatory stuff down there after that, right around when you were living there. I was 74 to 77. I was going down there for my music training and stuff.
Yeah, I was I was living in Lansing at that time. Very interesting, very interesting. I think your point, just to go back to your first point, that, you know, no commentator on the right is questioning the veracity of police, and that just speaks to this, to an authoritarian element within our society, and that the business of right wing media is to pander to that and to exaggerate that, to strengthen that, to make that larger, and that, in my opinion, makes us vulnerable to authoritarian takeover, frankly, and that's not a good thing. Anyhow, Paul, I got to move along. Thank you for the always thoughtful call. Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for everything you do. I'm not understanding you today because I don't think a lot of people have served on a grand jury.
Right.
And I have served on a grand jury.
Okay.
I was there for 8 weeks for one of Detroit's biggest drug busts.
Uh-huh.
And everything that they go through is very, you're fighting. I mean, you're with 11 other people and you are trying to get your point across. You are trying to go over every detail of what they've given you. And in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, the jury in this particular case was not given the proper information. They were giving very confusing information because before you go in there to deliberate, the judge is very firm when he tells you, if there's any reasonable doubt among any of you, you cannot convict.
Right.
And I think that's what happened. There was too much reasonable doubt, too much confusion.
But no, wait a minute. You're mixing up
that on the prosecuting attorney.
You're mixing up a grand jury and a trial jury.
No, but I've been on a grand jury. And when you go in there, that judge tells you, if you have any reasonable doubt,
there is no judge before a grand jury.
It's we were in front of one when I served.
Then your experience was not the kind of grand jury that happened in Ferguson, Missouri, because the type of grand jury that Bob McCullough had is a group of jurors, a group of citizens who are impaneled for, in some cases, years. These people had been sitting since May. They looked at case after case after case after case, including this case, and they work with the police and the prosecutor's office to bring indictments. And it's the theory is that it provides a little bit of safety to defendants. You know, that if the government is thinking about charging you with a crime, that there's a filter process. It's not just the prosecutor. It's kind of protects people from Rudy Giuliani-style grandstanding. If you remember back in I think it was in the 90s when he was the prosecutor in New York and he wanted to become mayor and he was running around busting head shops and just, you know, this spectacular stuff that he was, where he was playing knight on white horse. And it's like to try to prevent that. It's to try to be a buffer. But the other problem with the grand jury is that the evidence that the grand jury sees is only from one side. It's only from the prosecutor. And so typically, this is why the former chief justice in the New York State said that you could, you know, a good prosecutor could get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich, because the prosecutor has complete control over everything that the grand jury sees or doesn't see. Whereas in an actual trial, you have the prosecution present their case and you have the defense present their case. And then the jurors get to decide which one's right and which one's wrong and come to a conclusion. And that could be a jury or a grand jury or a high jury of some kind. But in this case in Ferguson, there was only one person presenting evidence, and that was Bob McCullough. And he was doing it in the context of basically defense lawyer. He was making the case for acquitting Darren Wilson. So.
Okay, because that's where I was confused, because on our grand jury, We had a judge. We were in there 8 weeks, and ours was a grand jury.
Ben,
they were bringing in heroin. They were bringing heroin and cocaine in Swiss cans, and they were all sealed in whatever, and there were four.
Yeah, but if there was a defense lawyer in there, then what you were experiencing is not the kind of grand jury that's used to bring indictments.
Right. That's where I was all
there's a difference. Okay, great. Linda, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your story with us. It's a great one. Appreciate it. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In fact, that conversation helped really clarify and illuminate some of these issues. And this is why, as Jesse Ventura said, you've got to have a trial. Welcome back. Steve, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network in Chicago. Hey, Steve, what's up?
What I'm about to say... I haven't heard on any radio or TV station, but if you look at the facts, it's pretty obvious. The way that they gave the decision last night was specifically designed to evoke violence.
How so?
And I can explain exactly how.
Okay.
First of all, the time of day.
Right.
Should never have been done at night.
Right.
Two, they did it at a time when they knew that the people that were trained in peaceful protest would not be out there.
Oh, that's interesting.
None of those groups were out there. They did all this training for nonviolence. They knew they weren't going to be out there when they made the announcement.
Well, but when they announced midday around 4 or 5 p.m. that they were going to make an announcement at 8 p.m. local time, don't you think the peaceful nonviolent protest groups said, okay, cool, we'll be there?
They weren't. That's the thing. And I think they realized that at that time of day they wouldn't.
Okay.
Plus, they had the National Guard there. First of all, the police were nowhere around the crowd. They put the police at one side and the other side. They put no police near the people to allow them to do anything they wanted to do, expecting them to do what they did and then just sort of close in on them and close them out. They were expecting it, and they just wiped up afterwards and, you know, let the destruction happen.
Yeah.
Now think, if they were protesting in a middle class or an upper class area, do you think the police would have been at each side and just let the people sit there?
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. It sounds like a conspiracy theory to say that the timing and the nature of the presentation, particularly the timing, the day and the time of day, both. Because had this been postponed until tomorrow, when most people are getting ready to travel or are traveling and getting ready for Thanksgiving, it might have been a very different response as well, was intended to produce a response where they could point to the response and shift the conversation away from the weakness of Bob McCullough and his grand jury and to the bad behavior of the rioters, as it were. And it sounds like a conspiracy theory, but it also makes sense.
Talking points, you know.
So what?
Look how violent and lawless all these black people are.
Yeah, that's what I said in the last hour. That the
power a right wing base.
Yeah, that the through narrative is black people gone wild, and Michael Brown was the first one, and now you got a whole bunch more, and that's basically what you turn on Fox, and that's what you get, and yeah. And it's a terrible, terrible thing. Thank you for the call, Steve. I appreciate it. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. For the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, and Lois in Glencoe, Maryland. Hey, Lois, what's up? Lois? Okay, let's try Bob in Sherman Oaks, California. Bob, can you hear me?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Bob.
The prosecutor in this case has a history of lies. He's been elected since 1991. You probably have already discussed that. I missed some of my verbal discussion.
I haven't, and I don't know what you're saying. So go. You know.
Well, he's dependent upon the voting electorate to keep his job, right. And he's had it for more than 20 years. Now, the worst case of his. Of him being a liar, the attorney, McCullough, had what they call the jack-in-the-box case in 2000, and the DEA officer shot and killed two unarmed black men in a parking lot. McCullough said that he had witnesses that said the car moved forward towards them. In other words, they were afraid for their lives. As it turns out, the St. Louis Dispatch did an investigation into this and found out that there was no evidence of any witness saying that the car moved forward. The men were unarmed, and yes, they had, and there was, you know, multiple, like 20-some shots, and they were killed. I mean, he has a number of cases like this in his history, which, of course, gets him elected. The biggest problem I find with what's going on in Ferguson, where are the black leaders that have all gotten, I hate to say the word, rich, such as Jesse Jackson and even Al Sharpton? Where are they that we had such a small turnout to change Ferguson by the majority of black people getting registered and being driven to the most recent election? We are not helping people who obviously need help to participate in their own lives. In the 60s, when I was in these things, there would be no problem. People got killed.
The voter, Bob, you're wrong. The voter turnout in Ferguson was 50% in the last election. Nationwide, it was 36%. So the voter turnout in Ferguson was huge compared to the rest of the country.
Okay. Then I'm wrong about that. Yeah. But 50% is still not enough, and
it's still not enough. But it's a hell of a lot better than the 24% that it was in the election that preceded that. So you know they're moving in the right direction. Bob, thanks for the call. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky.
Hello,
what's
Tom.
Up?
Yeah, I want to know how long did you figure out that there was going to be no indictment?
I always assumed that there would be no indictment because it's just very, very rare that a police officer is indicted for killing anybody, and particularly a white cop and a black teenager. It's just very rare.
This goes back to my
I didn't say this a lot because it sounds cynical, and I was hoping that I would be proven wrong, but I was always expecting this outcome.
I knew it. This is my theory's been all along. This is a lily white country, and these lily white politicians. You've seen the thing up there with all the white guys on the, you know, the Republican side. You're not going to take my country away from me.
Right.
And that's the way they operate. And whatever narrative they have to take, they pull this out of the grand jury. They give them just the information to lead them down the rat path, you know, to get to the cheese.
Yeah, yeah.
And they didn't give them all the information.
I think you know, Corky, you're right, and this is not a conspiracy theory. It's a matter of fact. Bob McCullough and his two assistants selected the information and the witnesses that would be presented to the grand jury, and you read some of the testimony. It clearly coached some of them. Corky, thank you for the call. Bill in Forked River, New Jersey. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, my opinion about the indictable offense is the fact that the police officer Wilson testified that he aimed for Brown's head, which means his intent was to kill him.
Well, that's always a police officer's intent when they pull their weapon. You only take your weapon out if you're willing to kill somebody.
Well, I realize that, but the fact is that the person is unarmed. All he had to do was lower the gun to the leg, and he takes him down. So,
yeah, but you know, police are not trained to do that. I mean, that's how they do it in the movies. But in real life, you're shooting at somebody's leg. You might miss them. The leg is a much smaller area. You might just you know, slightly graze them or wound them. And if they represent a serious threat to you, then you know, you're in worse shape than you were, and you've just wasted a few seconds when it only takes 5-10 seconds for somebody to attack you.
Well, then when you say you're going to shoot somebody in the head who's unarmed, then your intent is to kill an unarmed person.
That's correct. And therefore, you have to be able to demonstrate to a jury of your peers, in my opinion, that you had a legitimate reason for taking that shot. And that's why we have trials.
And he may have had a legitimate reason to take the shot, but all he had to do was shoot him in the legs and it's over.
Well, that's not how it works, Bill. But I understand your point, and wouldn't it be nice if that's how it worked? The alternative narrative to that, or another, you know, variation on that narrative, is he should have had a damn taser, and you know, a non-lethal force that could stop somebody who represented a physical threat but who was otherwise unarmed. And he didn't. Apparently, the entire department only had one taser.
Anything to enforce the law without killing somebody.
Yeah,
that's all I'm.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah. I'm with you. I think you know, America's horrified by the fact that you know, that this young man was killed just to begin with, as you know, point of fact. Bill, thank you for the call, and you know, we've covered a lot of territory today, but I think that the important carry home from this is the family of Michael Brown is asking to make sure that every police officer in the United States is wearing a body cam. And I think that's a very wise and appropriate suggestion. And B, that we have to figure out a way to have oversight of police that doesn't depend on local elected officials who have to work with the police day in, day out, and that does not depend on a grand jury process. And we need to come up with something, and we need to be implementing it all across the nation. I don't have a quick answer for that, but it's a conversation we need to have. Thanks so much for being with us today, and don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're in. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.